You are listening to the podcast of the Matyas Corvinus Collegium, the largest talent management institute in Hungary. If you want to know more about our mission, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter channels for interesting articles and analysis of our professors, external contributors, and students. Look up our knowledge base at corvinak.hu/en.
Welcome, everybody. This is the newest episode of the Diplomacy Podcast. My name is Attila Norbert Ferenc. I am the student of MCC's International Relations School. And I have the pleasure to have with me Dr. Callum Nicholson, the director of the MCC's Climate Policy Institute. This is actually the third time he's a guest for our podcast. Callum, thank you very much for being with us.
No, it's great to be back. Thank you.
And following our previous discussions, our topic today is climate change and media. And to start our discussion, we should define how climate change is presented in the media. Well, if we read several articles from well-known international media companies, for example, the Washington Post, the CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, what kind of image do we get?
Well, it's an interesting mixed bag, I think, because it really depends on what the media is reporting on. The problem is there is, of course, the science of climate change, but there's also how the science is interpreted. It's that there are questions around what our emphasis is when we look at the facts, what significance do we give them. All these questions are quite subjective in terms of what elements we choose to report on, how we choose to interpret them, and so on. But I do think that if you look at the media in general, and I can only really speak for the English language media, what I've seen in the last maybe 5 or 6 years in particular is an increase in what I term sloganeering, of using quite emotive shorthand to describe or to frame the whole topic of climate. Climate change, I think, is a really important issue. But I don't think it's helpful for the public discourse when newspapers, and indeed anyone else, is framing it as, for instance, the climate emergency or the climate crisis. I think it loads it in a sense, because it isn't simply then talking about climate change. It's also talking about us. It's talking about society. When we say emergency or crisis, of course, it's implied that it's an emergency and crisis for what? Well, for society. That presumes not just that we know the science of climate change, but that we know what society is, what it ought to be, how it's impacted by things by climate change. And as I'll probably talk a bit more about, I guess, in this podcast, the problem with the climate debate is not the science, it's often the social science. And so the framing of the climate crisis or emergency, I think, sometimes is a step too far. And I don't think it's helpful because it loads the whole debate so emotionally and so normatively that we get away from the important questions around rigor about what we actually are talking about.
So can we, considering what you said, can we rely on these mentioned above, or are only scientific journals and papers relevant sources?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, yeah, your question is basically, is the media reliable? And if not, or even if so, who is reliable?
Yes, implicitly.
Yeah, and as I said, the first of all, as I've said, the media is a mixed bag. But I think also we need to think about how the media works. I mean, there's people who report the news and there's people who write opinion editorials. In both cases, it's a very tight turnaround, tight deadlines. Typically, the people who write them are generalists, opinion op-ed contributors, if they are regular columnists, are not specialists on the topic in question. They may have an interesting angle on it, though, of course. Then you get just news reporting on a paper that comes out. And I do find often when you read the media covering the new release of a IPCC report or something, it's often based not on the scientific papers involved, but often the executive summary. And one of the problems with the IPCC reports is that the IPCC has three working groups. There's the scientific working group, the adaptation working group, and the mitigation working group. The scientific working group and the product of that, the hundreds of papers that come out of that, is very good. The science of climate change is good. There's very few errors that anyone's found in the last 30 odd years since the first one came out in, I think, 1990. But the problem is these documents also have executive summaries. And inevitably, an executive summary has to make certain editorial choices about what facts it reports, how they're emphasized, and so on. That is a much more subjective and inherently political exercise than the actual reports themselves. And then, of course, what you have are the media then reporting not probably on the papers themselves because they're too many to read and also they aren't necessarily specialists, but they're looking at the executive summaries and then summarizing those and publishing them usually from a political angle, depending on the paper. So I'm not sure how reliable the media sources are as a consequence of that. In terms of the actual scientific papers, again, the scientific papers around climate change, and I'm not a hard scientist. I'm more of a social scientist. But my understanding is, and my own observation is, it's good science. I don't know many people who
work... So it can be trusted.
I think so. But the problem is that, again, when we think about climate change, the discussion of climate and the science of climate is only half the discussion. Because why do we care about climate change? We care about it because we presume really two connected
because
things.
Because it impacts our lives.
Yes, we presume it will impact society and that the impact will be negative. Now, that requires us to understand, as I've said, not just climate, but society. The problem with the climate debate is not the science as such. It's the social science of impact. I mean, my sort of throwaway line about this that I'm quite fond of is our understanding of climate change is, I believe, informed less by a rich understanding of science and more by an impoverished understanding of ourselves. The science is good, but once we've solved all the questions of science, I think all the really interesting and most difficult questions remain untouched, which are really about what society is, what it ought to be, how does it change, how do we change it, all these sorts of things.
So what articles do you recommend then about climate change and other environment-related issues that can be trusted?
Well, when you're asking about what I recommend, we have to think about what is the purpose, you know. And I think the problem with climate change is not that we don't have enough data or enough specific studies. The problem is we don't have enough, I think, perspectives on it that take into account the whole picture. So, for instance, I'll give you just an analogy to this to make it maybe a bit simpler what I'm trying to say. You remember with the pandemic, with COVID?
Yes.
Often the discussion was about just COVID. It was about the science of COVID. It wasn't necessarily about the broader whole of society we live in. Because, of course, if we had a particular policy with COVID like lockdown, inevitably it has a whole range of unintended consequences for not only education and people's livelihoods and all these things, but also actually medical implications because people aren't going to get cancer screenings and so on.
Yes. That was a huge problem back then.
And not that this anecdote is data, but you know, I personally know more people who are impacted by not going to the doctor than people who are impacted by COVID in terms of people who've died as a consequence. Now, I'm not saying that's data, but it's anecdotally, it is a reminder to me that it's often on my mind that there were a lot of unintended consequences. The problem is we didn't have a whole perspective. And in the last year, there's been an inquiry in the UK into COVID, and people are not, they've not been examining questions about the proportionality of lockdown policies or how we take a complete picture of things, but rather simply focused on the COVID element of it. And by as a result of that, I think the inquiry is not a solution to the problems of how COVID was handled. It's simply another example of how badly it was handled. The reason I give the COVID example is I think the same applies to climate, that I think what we often lack are perspectives that set climate change in its broadest possible context. Because our lives are complex. We face many challenges every day, all of us. And climate is one element, but there are many other elements. Everything in life involves trade-offs and compromises. Personally, professionally, societally, however you see it, life is never ideal. It's always about finding some sort of practical, realistic balance. And I think this is what's often lacking in the climate debate is this type of perspective. So in the context of that, of saying we need a broader perspective, the best thing I could recommend to read would be the book by Mike Hume, who's a professor at the Department of Geography at the University of Cambridge. And Hume is H-U-L-M-E. And he has a book called, I believe, Why We Disagree About Climate Change.
Yes.
And he's a climate scholar. He's a legitimate, you know, Cambridge-based climate scholar. But he is really thought-provoking and I think wise and tempered in his view. And I think that book is a really good starting point.
Can you mention the main findings of this book?
Well, I think generally he's looking at what the sources of disagreement are when we people look at climate change, the different perspectives upon it, and trying to really weigh these out and look at the logic behind them, the implications of them, and so on. So he's just trying to put things in a broader perspective and to reflect, to have a reflexive component to look at not just what the facts of climate change are, but why we disagree over them. And which, again, is a problem less to do with the climate and more to do with ourselves. And I think that's the perspective that's often missing. We often think when we talk about climate that it is strictly to be understood as a scientific issue. But as we've talked about, it's interesting because it's presumed to have societal consequence. So obviously, it seems obvious then, we have to talk about what we mean by society. And I just don't think there is sufficient awareness that half of the discussion, and I think probably more than half the discussion, because it's the difficult part of the discussion, is not about the objective scientific facts. It's about the subjective societal values and political values we hold. How do we assess risk? What is a sacrifice worth making? For instance, I'm sure we could, again, take the COVID analogy. You know, I'm sure we could have got rid of COVID if we'd had a zero COVID strategy and locked everyone in their houses for several years, right?
But of course, China did.
Yeah, but it's not practical in the long term because the economy still needs to function. People still need to earn a living, and so on and so on. It's the same with climate, because in as much as the COVID debate had the rhetoric of zero COVID, it's interesting the climate debate has the rhetoric of carbon zero or net zero. And again, you could probably achieve net zero if you basically locked everyone up for years on end. But that's not how life is. Life isn't to be understood purely quantitatively or as a quantitative problem to be reduced or solved. Life is to be lived. There is a qualitative element to our lives. And I think if we start denying that, we are denying our humanity. And that's one of the dangers with the way climate is sometimes phrased, is it's quite, it's hard to phrase it, but I'd almost say anti-human sometimes. I don't want to over-egg that, but I do think that there is a sort of technocratic mentality in how we discuss climate change, which I believe is at odds with what we know and understand about the human condition, and indeed what is meaningful in our lives as human beings.
So actually, if we want to sum up what you said, we can say that everything depends on balances.
I think that's a good summary, actually, because, I mean, that's my perspective on most things, that I don't really believe the perfect ideal exists, whatever your politics. And I think the reality is that will never convince everyone anyway. The richness of society and life and the human condition is plurality. It's interesting with there's a big difference between the study of things and the study of people. And I don't think we talk about this enough. If you think about it, the study of things or the natural world or the physical world is a unity. The laws of chemistry and physics apply everywhere equally.
Yes.
But if you think about humanity, we're not a unity, we're a plurality. And that isn't a fault. It's a feature of who we are. It's not a problem. It's just who we are. It's everything that makes us who we are. It's everything that makes life meaningful to us, is that we're capable of seeing things from different perspectives, not just you and me, like looking at things differently, but
like,
you know,
everybody.
But I also mean within ourselves. I mean, I change my view on things depending. You know, I'm British, so I change my mind depending on how many cups of tea I've had throughout the day. But again, that's not a fault. That's a feature. That's where our creativity comes from. It's how we solve problems. It's how we stop making the same mistakes. I think this idea of compromise. And recognizing there is no perfect ideal, and that the opposite of idealism is not actually pessimism, it's simply realism. And I think so often people think if we're not idealists, we're pessimists. But actually, the opposite of idealism is simply to be realistic. And I think we are quite fearful these days of being realistic, because we think perhaps there's a moral sacrifice in being realistic, because we should really pursue our ideals. But there's the old phrase that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And
actually, I think that you said this last time.
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't remember, but there tends to be a through line in the way I look at things, and it doesn't matter the topic. And so I think this notion of compromise is something that's quite central to how I see things. There's a There's a great, I think I may have mentioned this in a previous podcast, but my favorite quote, I think, in the English language is from T.S. Eliot. And he wrote, "The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless." But if you think what humility is the ability to compromise. And the ability to compromise is humility. There is hubris in thinking that we can attain our ideals, and indeed that our ideals are best. There's a real hubris and arrogance in that. And actually to compromise, be it personally with someone else or professionally or societally, is intrinsically to take a sort of a more humble approach to things, to recognize our limits and that we're not gods, we're not omniscient, omnipotent, and and so on. So I think this is, I'd say it's quite a central way.
Well, can we find this hubris in the discourse about climate change today?
Well, it's funny, actually, because there is a book that was written several years ago by a Canadian scholar called Hubris. And I've read the book, and it's about climate change. And I've read the book, and he's an eloquent writer, and he makes, I think, compelling arguments looking at scientific overreach, or what philosophers of science would call scientism. That is, science not just as a guide to the facts, but a guide to our values that inform how we use and interpret the facts. It's a really interesting book. The problem is, there's almost no references in it. And I actually emailed the guy once to ask him for, say, this is an interesting argument.
What was the response?
Well, he didn't reply to me. So I can't recommend the book to anyone, because I simply don't see his sourcing. And you know, I'm a scholar, so I don't want to be recommending things that I can't see the chain of assertion, you know, or the chain of citation. But it was a really interesting book. I mean, I'd kind of recommend reading it as a rhetorical exercise, but I'm not sure how supported it is. It may well be, but maybe he didn't include the references. So I do think there is hubris, though. I mean, I think it was a well-titled book, because there is a hubris in how the climate is approached sometimes, because I think there's a hubris in thinking that all the questions we need to ask are scientific ones, and the only answers we need are scientific ones. And I think, as I've said, that most of the real questions remain not only unanswered, but unasked when we take that view.
Yes. So this was the first part of our discussion, and we will be back soon.
Thank you for listening to this MCC podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en, or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, and students, check out our knowledge base at corvinec.hu/en.